From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., trying to hang on to a summer that has passed all too quickly. Well, not so quickly. Indeed, after nearly 2 years of campaigning, we're nearing the home stretch in the nominating process. Yes, convention season is upon us, friends. And on today's program, we're going to take a look at what we can expect at these national party gatherings. From changes in how Democrats talk about one controversial topic in particular, to an issue of national importance that we hope will get attention on both sides of the red-blue divide. And finally, the big question that remains, who will be standing up there next to Barack Obama and John McCain? Later in the show, we'll be joined by Stephen Wallman of BeliefNet. Steve will give us his predictions on the vice presidential picks, and we'll talk with a prominent religious leader about the speech he hopes to hear in both Denver and Minneapolis at the convention headquarters. But first, some language that could also have a big impact. Do a few little words signal a major change in the values of the Democratic Party? Earlier this week, representatives from the Democratic Party met to draft their party's platform, the party's guiding principles, which will be presented and voted upon at the National Convention. Many in the press have noted new language in the document around one hot-button issue, abortion. Several progressive evangelical leaders are voicing their support for the change, saying the new approach is more welcoming to pro-life Democrats. I'm joined now by Tony Campolo, himself a leading evangelical minister, who served on the Democratic Party Platform Committee. Tony Campolo, welcome to State of Belief.
Good to be with you.
The language in the Democratic Party platform still affirms a woman's right to choose and clearly states the party's support for Roe v. Wade. So what's changed?
If you go to the party platform, there are three paragraphs. The first one does exactly what you say. The next two paragraphs are very important. They represent what we believe is a historic shift in the party, in which there is a strong commitment to reduce abortions in America, to reduce the number of them. 70% of the abortions in America are economically driven. That is, if you got a 17 or 18-year-old woman working at a minimum wage and she's pregnant, she stops to think, I'm working at a minimum wage, I can't support myself, let alone myself and a baby. I have no prenatal, postnatal care, no hospitalization, no possibility for daycare. I'm going to have an abortion because I can't afford to do otherwise. It seems to me, and it seems to the party platform people, that we need to address that. We believe we can reduce abortions by at least 50, maybe as much as 70%, if we address the economic forces that are driving women to having abortions, to address the issues that I just raised. That's what the party platform does. In the last two paragraphs, it calls for the reducing of abortions in America. It calls for addressing the economic forces that are driving women who want to carry their unborn to term and give birth, an opportunity to do so and not be hindered by economic forces that impress them. So that's the difference. Mm-hmm. We are committed to reducing abortions. That's new language in the party platform.
Did this change come from Barack Obama?
No, it didn't. It basically came from the Faith and Action Committee of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Howard Dean, the chair of the Democratic Party, reached out to religious leaders. And there was a committee formed, of which I am a part. I'm not only a part of the platform committee, but I'm also a member of the Faith and Action Committee. And the Faith and Action Committee brings together rabbis, imams from mosques, a lot of Protestant preachers, Catholic priests, so that we together can begin to address the party on the concerns of the religious population of America. Mm-hmm. They listened. They heard, and they said, let's work to this end. Those on the other side, groups like NARO and other groups that are very strongly pro-choice, also had their input. Everybody was listened to, and therefore we tried to come up with statements that didn't please anybody completely, but gave something to everybody in terms of the respective concepts of justice.
I'm speaking to Dr. Tony Campalo. Tony, let me ask you, and I want to be careful the way I ask this because it's a positive question, not a devious one. How do you balance the moral dimension of this change and the fact that you're also doing what you think is good political strategy?
I don't think in terms of political strategy. That's not my responsibility. My responsibility is to speak out of my convictions. Uh-huh. I think it's up to those who are trying to figure out how to win elections to say what is best for getting voters. Uh-huh. I am here as a representative of evangelicals saying these are the things that concern us. These are the values that we have. The moral landscape in America is changing. First of all, the abortion issue. 51% of Americans are pro-choice. 43% are pro-life. That's not from some liberal group. That's from the Catholic Research Council. That's what the Catholics, who are very pro-life, have found. And thus, we are looking for some realistic steps that we can take to reduce abortions in America. But it should be noted that the political agenda has broadened for evangelicals, especially younger evangelicals, under the age of 35. Yes, they are still conservative on that issue, but they are also concerned about poverty, intensely concerned about poverty. The war in Iraq, I mean, if you're talking about a pro-life issue, I mean, 300,000 innocent Iraqis have been killed as a result of our invasion. That concerns evangelicals. And we are raising some very serious questions about some of the pro-life issue. You know, Cardinal Bernardine in Chicago mm-hmm. talked about the seamless garment. He said, if you're going to be pro-life, it's got to be pro-life all the way. You not only have to be opposed to abortion, you have to be opposed to war, you have to be and work for peace in negotiations, you've got to be opposed to capital punishment, you have to do away with poverty. Consider this, 30,000 children under the age of 12 die every 24 hours because of either starvation or diseases related to malnutrition. If you want to be pro-life, you've got to address that issue, or else you are subject to the accusation that evangelicals only care about life at one level. I said sarcastically, you evangelicals think that life begins with conception and ends at birth, because once the child is born, you don't care anymore. You don't step forward and want to introduce those government programs that will enable these poor children to survive with dignity.
From the same perspective of religious conviction, moral conviction, out of which you described your work on this new language, how do you feel about the rest of the platform?
Well, the rest of the platform is what I think you would expect of Democrats They are very, very interested in, quote-unquote, the little person. And we've always been the party of those who are struggling. And the platform reflects those values. Now, there are those who are going to say it's liberal. And indeed, they are right. It's liberal. What I want to know is, when did liberal become a bad word? It seems to me that Martin Luther King was a liberal. And if we go back to our fathers and mothers who gave birth to this country, Jefferson, Franklin, they were liberals. As a matter of fact, I contend that conservatives are people who worship at the graves of dead liberals, but have little respect for those that are alive.
Tony Campolo is an author and a professor emeritus at Eastern University in Pennsylvania. He's also an evangelical minister. I can tell you from experience, he is a terrific writer and speaker. He served on the Democratic Party Platform Committee. And, Tony, I really appreciate you being with us on State of Belief.
Good to be with you, friend. Take care of yourself.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. While Democrats debate their party's approach to reproductive rights, up next, a look at one issue that we hope both parties will be talking about. A group of interfaith leaders have just drafted a letter with a request for Barack Obama and John McCain. Find out what that letter says when we come back. See you in a minute. State of Belief, I'm Welton Getty, president of the Interfaith Alliance. As the end of August nears, both Republicans and Democrats are gearing for their respective parties' national conventions, writing party platforms and lining up speakers. Well, recently, a group of interfaith leaders, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, got together and drafted a letter sent to both Senator McCain and Obama with a request. When those cameras are rolling in Denver and Minneapolis, the letter asks, please make an effort to address one ever-important issue to the American public, poverty. The letter calls for each candidate to make a primetime speech during the conventions that will address the plight of America's needy, and this request couldn't come at a more appropriate time. This year's conventions will fall right around the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, a tragedy which showed us horrifically how many Americans live in poverty. And joining me right now by phone is one of the signers of this letter, Reverend Michael Kinnaman. Reverend Kinnaman is the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. Michael, welcome to State of Belief.
Nice to be with you.
As you look at it, how has poverty been addressed so far in this election cycle?
Well, there has been, of course, during the primary campaign, conversation about the issue, but it's not been, at least the signers of this letter felt, and I agree with that, it's not been put front and center as the kind of dominating issue that we think it has to be for this country. As you know, some like Senator Edwards had made this part of their major platform, but it's not surfaced as the kind of issue with that affects all of the country, and especially the gap between rich and poor in a way that we think has to happen in the future.
The letter that we're talking about, Michael, was signed by Muslims and Jews and Christians. What for you illustrates the commonality in thinking about poverty across these different faith traditions? Was it easy to come together on this, or was it difficult?
You know, that's one of the encouraging things for me is we clearly do have common faith principles out of which this kind of commitment grows. Part of it has to do with the infinite value of every human life. Mm-hmm. This is a foundational principle, the interdependence of human life and human community, which was an easy principle for us to identify. And then out of that grows a priority concern for those who are most vulnerable in society. From that, we were able to name the immorality of ignoring the most vulnerable and the call for this to be at the top of the agenda.
You are the head of a massive institution, really, with great diversity and pluralism in it within the Christian tradition. I'm curious, and I don't quite know how to ask the question, but do you see poverty as one of the missions that you have alongside of other missions, or is it even more integral than that?
Yes. Our purpose as the National Council of Churches is to manifest the unity of the Christian community. And we often talk about common witness to the world so that we respond to those who are in need and those who are poor. But of course, one of the sources of division that keeps Christians from living more fully together is this disparity between rich and poor, which itself is a source of not simply diversity, but division. The fact that some people barely scrape by, if at all, from month to month, and some have lavish excess, isn't simply a diversity within the church. That also is a source of division that keeps us from fully claiming one another. And so the poverty agenda isn't just an agenda of mission that where you address the world. It also is a question of what it means to be the church. And thus it has to be at the very center of the National Council's agenda. This isn't something tacked on to our fundamental purpose. It's right at the core of what it is that we're about if we're to be the church.
Well said. Reverend Michael Kinnaman is the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches of Christ, USA. Michael, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much, Will.
You know, it surely would be a shame to go through a national election, especially for the president, and not address this issue. Across the years, philosophers have told us that the best measure of the moral strength of a nation is how it treats its poorest and weakest people. This is a good reminder, and I hope when you talk to your candidates that you'll talk to them about their response to poverty as well as to other issues that you care about. Well, friends, what issues do you think need to be addressed other than poverty in this year's conventions? What should our candidates be talking about? What issues affect your life? Tell us. We want to know. Go to the Contact Us page on stateofbelief.com and share your ideas. Look, we live in a democracy, and we think our thoughts should be shared. We think your thoughts should be heard. Help us bring your voice to the air. But don't go there yet. Up next, a look at who could be hitting the campaign trail with Obama and McCain. When we come back, we'll talk vice presidential candidates with BeliefNet's Steve Wallman. Stay tuned. Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy, and thanks for joining me here on State of Belief. Lately, the news has been dominated by two epic events, the Olympics and a competition of a different sort, the choosing of vice presidential candidates. And while sports enthusiasts are making their predictions about who will climb the Olympic platform to receive medals in swimming, gymnastics, or basketball, political pundits and journalists are placing their bets on who's going to mount the stage at the conventions to receive the nomination for vice president. Well, here to advise us on this, politics, not pole jumping or the pummel horse, is a good friend of State of Belief, Steve Wallman. Steve's the editor-in-chief and co-founder of BeliefNet.com, a website dedicated to issues of religion and spirituality. Steve, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks so much for having me again.
You're a brave man because everyone has predictions about the vice presidential picks. Let's just begin with you telling us your top picks for both the Republican and Democratic VP slots.
Well, I kind of surprised myself on this. I did an article where I kind of went through each candidate and tried to assess the candidates sort of from a faith factor point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Democratic side, I kept coming up with the logic pointing to Joe Biden. And the reason it surprised me is that previously in the month or so before, I wouldn't have even put him in the top 10. As you know, and I'm sure you've talked about a lot on the show, one of the big political questions this year is how can Obama do better among Catholics? And when you look at the list of potential running mates for Obama, there's a whole bunch of Catholics. But there's a problem, which is, as John Kerry found, if you're a pro-choice Catholic, you're in a bit of a difficult spot in the Democratic Party because you get attacked by not only conservative Catholics, but inevitably some part of the Catholic Church hierarchy. So part of how I ended up with Biden is he's Catholic, too. He's from Delaware. But he is has not been the targets of antagonism from conservative Catholics in the same way because he's kind of a centrist on abortion, basically.
Mm-hmm. What about on the Republican side?
I am going to say Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, who his disadvantage is obviously the one that's happening right now in your audience as people are going, who?
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly a household name. His advantages are that he's from Minnesota, which is a state that's in play. He is a strong evangelical, but he's not viewed as having a lot of baggage. He's youthful and a fresh face and outside of Washington.
Are these guys looking at religion that seriously in making this choice?
The honest answer is I don't know. Only they know what is the deepest factor, and I think it's a secondary factor.
Well, I know that it won't surprise you if you hear me say that I hope it is second or third down the list, because I have to admit I remain concerned about how much attention is being paid to religion in selection of candidates.
Right.
We need a good president and vice president, whether or not they're religious.
Well, this is a bit of it's an occupational hazard for me because I run a religion website, so naturally I always think that religion is the most important factor in everything.
Yeah. Well, Steve, you've written a book on faith, religious liberty, and the founding of this country. In 100 years, when historians are writing about the 2008 election and the role of religion in it, what are they going to say?
I think it's going to look like, you know, if they chart this on a graph, and as you know, we have sort of ebbs and flows throughout history of when religion becomes a big deal in campaigns, and then it kind of goes away, and then it comes back. And we seem to be at a high point. You know, it looked like we could not possibly go any higher than the last election. But in a way, we have gone higher because while McCain isn't pushing it as hard, Obama is pushing it much harder than Democrats have in the past. And, you know, this ad that McCain did the other day implying that Obama has a messianic complex, this ad called The One,
it hit the
internet at the same time there was this very odd but sort of surprisingly prevalent sentiment that Obama is the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
When historians look back at this and they look at, you know, the one party sort of, or at least some part of the electorate looking at the one of the other candidates as the Antichrist, and one of the candidates sort of seeming to stir the pot on that a little bit, I mean, that's pretty out there.
It certainly is, and I tell you the truth, I would be really scared of the Antichrist identity were it not for the fact that Hal Lindsey has endorsed that, and Hal Lindsey has been wrong about the end of the earth in every decade.
He's going to get it right one of these days.
Yeah, if you keep saying it. Steve, I hear that Obama will be announcing his running mate via email or text. Are you on the list?
I just signed up just for that purpose. I don't want to be the last guy to know.
Well, I tell you what, if we've got this on tape, and if you are right, we're going to probably bring you back and give you some kind of State of Belief award, and if you're wrong, we may replay the tape.
Oh, no. Wait, now, did you tell me who you were predicting?
I didn't, because I haven't. I know that phrase, I'm a working journalist. I am a working religious leader, and so I don't endorse.
Okay.
Steve Wallman is the editor-in-chief and co-founder of BeliefNet.com, a website where you can find all kinds of great information on religion and society, faith and politics, and issues of spirituality. Steve, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here.
I hope you'll check out some of Steve Wallman's updates on faith and the conventions at BeliefNet.com. And while you're there, you can also check out the newest addition to the site, a blog called Progressive Revival. This blog brings together a great good many of today's leading thinkers on progressive religion, including, on occasion, me. Coming up on State of Belief, we're off to summer camp, a very special kind of summer camp, one dedicated to teaching kids about diversity. That's up next. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. We're just about out of time today, but before we go, I want to share with all of you some insights into a very special program that is sponsored by the Interfaith Alliance, the organization of which I'm president. Every summer, we offer a unique learning experience for a select group of high school students. It's a summer camp of sorts, and it's called the LEAD Camp, L-E-A-D-D. This year, 41 students from around the country and from 17 different belief backgrounds gathered in Washington, D.C. to spend the week learning about the First Amendment to the Constitution, discussing religious and cultural diversity, and discovering that what makes us all different is what makes this country great. We visited the LEAD Camp and spoke with some of the counselors and campers. I want you to have a listen at what they said.
My name is Denny Davidoff, and I'm the director of the LEAD program as a senior consultant to the Interfaith Alliance Foundation. The LEAD program is an immersion in the issues of religious liberty in this country. It is designed for high school students, and we teach them about how the founders came to write the First Amendment, and we do a lot of work around the First Amendment with particular emphasis on those clauses.
I'm just curious, how many, just raise your hand if you've been in a situation where somebody has been basically discriminated against. And
my name is Abel Gilbert, and I am from Brandon, Florida. I am Roman Catholic. I came to LEAD because one of my closest friends had recommended it, first of all, and hearing about what LEAD and the Interfaith Alliance is all about, I became very, very interested because coming here to America, first of all, I know firsthand how different it is. You know, this entire world is filled with diversity, and coming here would be an amazing experience, like it has been, for me to learn more and grow as a person. Getting to know these different cultures, religions, and faiths.
Exactly, yes. What you're asking for, but one of my best friends is Jewish, and we were learning about world religions, and we didn't have any Jewish kids in our class. So she.
Hi, I'm Lauren Carroll, and I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. I had a friend who came here last year, and he told me about the experience, and it just sounded really great and like something I would love to do. That's why I decided to come, because everyone who has come already sounded like they had a great time.
And that day we had a substitute teacher, and she was constantly being interrupted by him.
You know, in these sessions where we're all telling deeply personal stories, because religion is a deeply personal subject, it's really great to know that because we're all excited to be here and we're all eager to learn, that we're comfortable with each other and open to teaching each other about our beliefs and learning about other people. And even though we've only been here a week, we're all incredibly close, so there's really no restrictions in what we're able to be open about with each other.
One thing I noticed is that whenever I watch the news, 99% of the times when you see Muslim or Islam, it won't be Muslim or Islam, it'd be Muslim terrorists or Islamic terrorism.
Hi, my name is Jamal Barakat. I'm from Moore Park, California, right by LA, and I follow Islam. Me and my friends, we don't really talk about religion, so it's nice to come here and talk about it and see other people's views and clear stuff up.
Well, all throughout my younger childhood, I've been told by adults that I was going to go to hell because I was Buddhist.
You know, I came in here thinking I had a pretty good knowledge of different religions, and then I came here and I learned so much more that I didn't even think to ask before.
I learned a lot more, like, for example, last night in the question and answer session that we had about the Sikh religion. I have personally heard very, very little about him. And I'm very fascinated, actually.
Last year, I remember as one of our students was leaving, she said to me, I'm very, very close to my family, and I have talked about things with these new friends this week that I have never even discussed with my family. So that's one of the things that happens here.
So Maddie, and then Molly, and then...
You know, we can definitely just relate to each other, and... yeah, we just became a nice little family in the little week that we've been here. So
the people who were here in 2006 are all still in touch with each other. They know that they can count on the support of the Interfaith Alliance staff. You just one by one create a hopefully a national movement for pluralism and for understanding and for defenders of religious liberty, which is all about what the mission of the Interfaith Alliance is about.
In addition to the week-long lead camp, we've also begun offering a shortened version called Weekend Lead. The next one's coming up soon in Tampa, Florida on August 29 through 31. If you want more information, and I hope you do, on Lead, or if you think this is an experience your child might profit from, then visit the website of Interfaith Alliance. That's interfaithalliance.org. As you know, financial support for the Interfaith Alliance assures support for programs such as LEAD and for the broadcast of State of Belief. Over the past 3 weeks, we've asked you for financial help. I just have to be honest with you. I don't like doing that. We characterize State of Belief as religion and radio done differently. I have no ambition to come to this microphone with my hands out for your money like a latter-day Oral Roberts or any one of 1,000 evangelists who will tell you the world is going to be near its end if you don't send them money and help keep them on the air. Look, here's the deal for me. You know the Interfaith Alliance needs money. I promise to tell you if a time comes when we don't need money. And until then, I hope you'll remember our financial crunch and help us if you can. But there is no charge for listening to us, writing to us, speaking to us, or engaging in this show with us. Two news stories grabbed my conscience this past week. I simply must say a word or two about them. Among desperate people, anger peaks easily and dismisses reason quickly. Words touch emotions and evoke reactions, often hostile and volatile. No one knows for sure what was going on inside the psyche of a gunman in Little Rock who shot and killed the head of the Democratic Party in Arkansas. In a highly politicized environment laced with hardball partisanship, our tendency is to suspect such a tragedy has an ideological or political dimension to it. And, of course, that in itself is sad. Well, whatever the cause of that senseless tragedy in Little Rock, all of us will do well to measure our words. Efforts to motivate voters should never degenerate into a fiery harangue that sets off an explosion in an already unbalanced, sick, or psychotic mind that could produce a violent attack on another person or a representative of some particular group. Now, speaking of words, this past week, I was astonished at the words of righteous indignation that spewed from the mouths of so many journalists eager to get to a word processor or microphone and condemn as well as verbally stomp on John Edwards in response to the former presidential candidate's extramarital sexual promiscuity. It was a shocking display of a sense of moral perfectionism that I never would have guessed existed. Not. Of course Edwards did wrong. Yes, legal questions could have been involved, and they should be addressed. Did Edwards hurt his party? Possibly. But maybe I missed this. Who was supposed to be helped by all of the evening cable TV pundits lobbing grenade after grenade at Edwards? What was the good they meant to accomplish? Given the pseudo-religiosity involved, surely all of these moral judgmentalists know scriptures in which holy people said of people in their position, "Put down your stones." I hope these journalists remember the important counsel, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." And I hope they don't mess up and pray, "Forgive us as we forgive others." If that's the case, all of us are in danger. Because I'm not aware of any contemporary who has achieved perfection. Of course, I could be wrong. But if so, I have not yet heard that reporter's or pundit's commentary. Well, that's our show for this week. Don't forget to stay in touch with stateofbelief.com, where you can download past shows and you can check out the latest news. And while you're there, please send us an email from the Contact Us page or call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. And as always, we wouldn't be able to bring this program to the airwaves each week without listeners like you who become members of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We're looking forward to being with you again next week. I'll try to calm down a little. Actually, no, I won't. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Getty, and that's State of Belief.
Preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.